Thanks so much to Jürgen and also to the center, yes, for supporting this research through the funding scheme and also for arranging this event tonight. My great pleasure to be reporting, to give actually the first reporting of the research project on this very topic, circulations of urbanism and real estate capital. Looking at the ways in which Korean and Singaporean developers were operating in cities of Vietnam, especially in this case, in my case, I'm looking at Hanoi and Ho Chi Minh City, and trying to understand how they are competing with local developers. It's more going to be about urban politics, so I'm sorry, we have to stay with the politics dimension, despite Jürgen's initial introduction. But at the same time, I would say, not as an excuse, but this is very in capital letters, preliminary findings. So I'm hoping to hear some input from the audience, especially those of you who are more familiar with the Southeast Asia and also with Vietnam's urban landscape a lot more than I do. A little bit of background of mine is I've been doing research on urbanization, the politics of urbanization and political economy of urban development, looking at primarily up until now, before this project, in East Asia. Yes, East Asia, where do you draw the boundary between East and Southeast? I mean, it's all blurry. But I've been looking at primarily mainland Chinese and South Korean cities. So Beijing, Guangzhou, and Seoul have been my research, main empirical site of my research. And from about 2 years ago, I've been starting to look at Vietnam, initially with an idea of, you know, comparing eventually the experience of Vietnam with the experience of mainland Chinese cities, especially in terms of how cities are going through changes in times of transition from a socialist to a market, from a planning to a market economy. And eventually with another plan to compare the experience of Singapore with the experience of South Korea, as the two countries, Singapore and South Korea, being part of the developmental stage in the development studies and international development literature, and trying to kind of have a kind of, you know, comparative understanding of how things have been changing. So in that regard, I'm situating this Vietnam research in that context as the very beginning of longer term, larger scale comparison to be made. So in the next about 45 minutes or so, I try to kind of, you know, go through the stories. Given the research context, I'm trying to kind of share what I have found out, especially during my visits in April and in July to Hanoi and Ho Chi Minh City last year, and trying to see, you know, what can be learned from my preliminary thinking about the whole, you know, stories that come out from Vietnam. Well, as a starting point, I mean, the initial understanding is the whole experience of urbanization in East Asia, especially, as I was saying, South Korea and Chinese cities in the mainland, which have gone through during the last few years, especially for a couple of decades in particular. In the case of mainland Chinese cities, since the beginning of the economic reform, especially since the early 1990s, when the Chinese government began to experiment with the establishment of land and housing markets, and South Korea having gone through a very condensed experience of urbanization. So these two economies were having seen, were seeing in a very condensed forms of urban development, leading to what I refer to as vertical accumulation. So very high concentration, high density, high volume development, targeting those, you know, strategic locations within cities. This doesn't necessarily mean every, you know, inch of the city has gone through similar, you know, the same type of development. There's, of course, as geographers, it's always important to mention the unevenness of this development. So within cities, within regions, within countries, there will be inevitable uneven process of development, right? But when you actually look at those major, you know, places like Beijing, Seoul, or Shanghai, Guangzhou, and so on, and nowadays Chengdu and so on, in mainland China, you see in a high concentration of developmental activities changing the landscape in a very significant way. And you see something similar going on in London as well. And if you were here in London 10, 20 years ago and look at the city or the Canary Wharf from distance, you would have seen very different landscape, very different from what you see nowadays, very high density, high volume development to make the most out of the real estate profiteering opportunities, right? So in the case of South Korea, this country has gone through the huge process of urban changes leading to the situation in which the majority of the population living in high-rise condominiums. So about 60% of the entire housing units found in South Korea are basically high-rise condominiums, which is very different from what it used to be about 30 to 40 years ago, when the high-rise apartment used to be almost absent in the 1970s and emerging very rapidly from the 1980s onward. You have again in Singapore, many of you who may have had the chance to go to Singapore will see it's a very high-rise society, right? All the HDB housing units are provided in high-rise forms, and all the luxury dwellings are again in high-rise forms, with some few small exceptions of landed properties like villas, which are earmarked for the consumption by the very rich. But otherwise, low-income to middle-income households would usually live in high-rise apartments, right? When you look at Beijing, now we kind of see, here's my the need of changing my mentality, and now from Beijing to Hanoi and to Ho Chi Minh City. When you look at Vietnam, what is interesting, especially in cities like Hanoi and Ho Chi Minh City, there has been very noticeable change during the last 10 plus years from a rather sprawl-based low-rise at the most in a 4 to 5 story in tube houses and dominating landscape to a different landscape that begins to see the emergence of high-rise clusters of buildings, not only in CBD areas, but also real estate, the residential neighborhoods, turning into high-rise estate. So my question in this case is, well, when you actually look at the Beijing's still not into Vietnam mode of thinking, when you look at Vietnamese cities, in addition to the rise of high-rise estate, you also see the proliferation of foreign developers, especially those coming from Singapore and South Korea, and to some extent from Taiwan. And these are becoming very noticeable and influential players, especially during the last 10 years in Vietnam's real estate market in the higher middle to higher end, especially the higher end, which is aiming for the top income earning households. When you kind of look at these emerging influences of the Korean and South Singaporean developers operating in Vietnam, you begin to wonder, what do they actually bring to Vietnam? And how do they actually refer back to their own experience of developing high-rise estates and new towns, which are, again, seeing the concentration of high-rise properties in South Korea or in Singapore? What does their experience actually tell us about the way in which they operate in Vietnam? And to what extent do they have to negotiate with the local conditions when they actually bring in their own expertise? And more fundamentally, what does that increasing presence of Singaporean and South Korean developers in Vietnam mean for the social and spatial inequalities in Vietnam's new landscape? So ultimately, my questions are really trying to understand the way in which these foreign developers are influencing and changing the landscape of social and spatial inequalities in Vietnam, which has also gone through fundamental are going through fundamental changes in terms of what sort of built forms are being provided in the major cities of Vietnam. So I won't be able to give the entire answers to my own questions. It'll have to wait until I go back to my own desk and my own office, and after having the chance to get more feedback from you from the audience, and going through another round of deep thinking to understand about all these questions and put those into, yes, in a more concrete writing, which I hope will be able to come out fairly soon. Vietnam's housing market, very briefly, and we all, probably people here will understand, yes, Vietnam has also gone through this economic reform during Moi from about 1986. I'm not here to go through the entire experience, the historical experience of the economic reform and so on. What is important just to acknowledge is the whole transition from a planned economy to a market economy was coming with still the nominal acknowledgement and continuance of the socialist nature of the republic, right? So to some extent, I was quite surprised when I was entering the country for the first time, when I was looking at the stamp, visa stamp on my passport. Unlike, yes, I mean, China also has the People's Republic of China stamp when you enter Chinese and border, across the Chinese borders. But Vietnam is quite refreshing to actually still see Socialist Republic of Vietnam in the stamp. And I think that ethos is still somehow going to be quite important to understand how people are to respond to the way in which the local government and developers are intervening in their daily life. Hanoi and Ho Chi Minh City's provision of high-end and middle-end housing has become very noticeable during the last 10 years, as I was saying. There used to be high-end in a property market in a booming situation until the 2008 and 9 global financial crisis, and there was a bit of stagnant period between 2009-ish and 2014. And from 2015 onward, the Vietnamese government has been introducing new changes to facilitate foreigners' investment in the real estate market of Vietnam. So from July 2015, foreigners, if they were having legitimate visa as a tourist or even as a tourist or as a resident, they were able to purchase real estate property that comes with 50-year leasehold ownership. So, and the 50-year leasehold is eligible to renew when it expires. Although there were some restrictions on this condition of purchase, so when you look at a building by building situation, the restrictions included the fact that foreigners are able to buy up to 30% of units in any single condominium building. So there was a bit of a restriction in order to prevent entire estate from completely being dominated by foreigners, which I think was fairly interesting and useful measure. But nevertheless, this didn't prohibit foreigners from investing in major estates that are emerging in Hanoi or Ho Chi Minh City. And this was in the context of, by the way, most of the pictures are pictures of mine, so unless they are indicated otherwise. This figure coming from World Bank, a 2015 report, provides interesting numbers. So up until 1994, most of housing provision was by so-called self-built provision of housing. So individual families essentially providing their own dwellings in the way that can be seen in the upper in the top picture. Does this work? Yes. I mean, these so-called tube houses tend to be the main built form in Vietnamese cities, and these were emerging here and there in city centers, in peripheries, whenever there's a land plot available for people to occupy and build their own dwellings. Whereas over the years, from late 1990s, Vietnam begins to see the increasing presence of commercial developers, which include both private and state-owned enterprise. And it is in this context, especially from mid-2000 onward, the high-end luxury housing market, that are seeing the concentration of foreign developers are actively operating this commercial and developer provided dwellings, which occupy up to about 20% or somewhere between 15% to 20% of housing provision. That's the kind of territory the foreign developers are operating within. And this is in the context of Vietnam having going through a bit of a rapid urbanization, especially in terms of demographic transition-wise. more and more people, you know, living in cities. So with the Doi Moi, you know, kind of changing what used to be more or less kind of a very low growth rate of population, urban population, or nearly like resembling what can be seen as like a zero urbanization in during the 1980s or 70s. There's kind of, you know, from 1990s onward in a great increase of urban-based populations, and the estimation is by 2025-ish, there will be more urban population than rural population in Vietnam. So that kind of in a concentration of urbanite in cities also known to be by many critics to fuel the increased provision of housing, especially by commercial developers. It's also interesting to see, you know, especially in the, in our discussion of Korean and Singaporean developers, they have also made their presence in Vietnam's foreign direct investment as space. So South Korea now tops the chart in terms of having invested the largest volume of capital in Vietnam. It's also interesting to just as a note, you know, for those people who are interested in this particular aspect, Samsung on its own have invested about $10 billion. So that's about and Samsung's export. Samsung does operate in three major complexes in Vietnam, one of which is in the outskirts of Ho Chi Minh and also in the outskirts of Hanoi. So Samsung's export accounts for about 22.7% of Vietnam's total export turnover, which is quite substantial, especially when you think of how Samsung's hiccup will influence Vietnam's economy quite substantially. And Singapore also, is in the top three in terms of contributing to the foreign direct investment coming into Vietnam. Well, when you look at the sector, real estate, I mean, manufacturing being coming at the very top of the chart of foreign direct investment in Vietnam by sector, that's understandable. But real estate is the second largest receiving sector. In the case of Vietnam's foreign direct investment. When you look at South Korea's own investment in Vietnam and dividing this into sectors, yes, manufacturing, of course, dominates and largely benefiting from Samsung's own contribution. But at the same time, the real estate comes to be rather not too big. When you look at Korea's own investment in Vietnam, but what is also interesting is when you actually look at the real estate sector only, and this is a report from Jones Lang LaSalle, and a research report that came out in 2018. When you look at Vietnam only, you get to see South Korea having, despite the overall percentage of South Korea's foreign direct investment in Vietnam in real estate of Vietnam is not that big compared to manufacturing and others. In the area of real estate of Vietnam, when it comes to foreign direct investment, Vietnam's real estate does get heavily influenced by South Korean investors' presence. So in this case, I don't know whether you can actually see all the small captions, but this is for Vietnam, and that yellow one is referring to South Korean's presence when it comes to the share of real investment from different countries. And Hong Kong, in this case, in the case of Vietnam, is one of the largest contributors. When you actually look at the intra-regional capital, so the top chart doesn't include intra-regional and the capital flows, so it doesn't include Singapore's own contribution. So when you actually want to understand how Singapore has been playing its own presence in Vietnam, this shows the scale. So for Vietnam, Singapore, having contributed somewhere between about $150 million, which is, I guess, a little more than what South Korea was contributing to Vietnam. So Singapore does operate quite heavily within Vietnam and within the region. This is just a kind of indication to show in a little kind of wider, bigger picture. The growth to fixed capital formation-wise, which refers to all those investment that goes into the built environment, infrastructure, and other production facilities, and so on. You can kind of see in Vietnam, when you compare it to with the world average, of course that's referring to China, and China's in a heavy and rapid growth rate in terms of GDP in recent years, were according to many reports, were contributing heavily by, were benefiting heavily by the heavy investment in a fixed asset formation. The same goes to South Korea, especially in the 1980s and 90s, when they were seeing heavy investment in the formation of fixed capital. Vietnam has also gone through a similar process, especially in the early 2000 to mid-2000-ish. And that also is an indication of how much Vietnam has been investing heavily in the formation of fixed capital, including infrastructure and so on. So, and also when you actually look at this in a comparison between gross fixed capital formation and gross savings, it does indicate, well, for example, if the line is above 100% it will indicate there are more need of investment than what can be financed by gross savings, domestic gross savings. So in that regard, you have to kind of think of additional source of investment coming from elsewhere, like foreign direct investment and so on, in order to finance the fill in the gap between what is required for investment in fixed capital and what can be sourced through the use of the gross savings that can be found within each country. And when you actually look, this is just an indication to show in East and Southeast Asia, a lot of these countries have been seeing a lot more really growing affluence, more savings available than what can be what were invested in gross fixed capital formation, which also indicates to some extent the degree of presence of what can be seen as the surplus capital that can be used to finance these various real estate projects, which are often the case in China or South Korea. This is just a summary of what I was saying earlier, so I won't go too much into details. So foreign home ownership-wise, the new law, especially from 2015, July, was allowing foreigners to purchase without restriction, but with some limitations on the number of units that can be purchased in a given condominium building. But essentially, foreigners being able to purchase a condominium unit that comes with 50-year leasehold ownership, which can be renewed when it comes to the expiry date. And foreigners also being able to make use of their property ownership to gain additional income by renting it out or selling and resale and so on. And if the foreigners are wishing to purchase a property without any restriction of land use right, another option that it has been made possible is you marry a local Vietnamese and you buy the property. So these are the kind of vernacular urban forms in Vietnam that can be found in many cities, right? And very often these are seeing very high concentration in major city centers, but also these forms can also be found in peripheral areas of major Vietnamese cities. The top left refers to kind of Soviet style walk-up blocks that was found in Ho Chi Minh City, built in the 1960s-ish, early 1960s, I think. This was in very early period. I have to go back to my source. I think it was in Hanoi, actually, if you think of the period. The other pictures are referring to those neighborhoods that can be found, those tube houses which are often coming with 4 or 5 story or sometimes 3, which are pretty much residential, with some exceptions of ground floor being turned into shop spaces. But these are while these are predominant forms of residential units, space that can be found in major Vietnamese cities. And we get to see these high rises emerging one after the other, right? So this is one of the local Vietnamese developer provided in a luxury high-end residential estate called Royal City in Hanoi. But these are essentially ones that are appearing one after the other to cater or to target those in the higher end in the income owners. So there's kind of a gradual replacement one after the other, but especially it's interesting to see whereabout these projects are being concentrated. As a brief history of how high rises were being introduced, it's quite interesting to understand the contribution made by Taiwanese business person. So in Ho Chi Minh City, actually, this is like a legendary story among architects in Vietnam that I met. So in my research, I haven't said in detail about the visit to Hanoi and Ho Chi Minh City last year was involving the interviews with about 50 people, so about 55 people who come from diverse backgrounds, and the majority coming from developers and other architects and so on. It's often the Phu My Hong in Ho Chi Minh City is referred to as kind of a legendary story where the high-rise living has been introduced and has become a bit of a sensation. Not from the very beginning, because initially this was something people were not used to, and especially when Phu My Hong, which is the name of the developer in Ho Chi Minh City, set up as a local developer company and owned by Central Trading and Development Corporation, which is the name of the company set up by a Taiwanese business person in 1989. Initially, with the contribution coming from the Nationalist Party of Taiwan. So they were the Nationalist Party was approaching, the finance minister was approaching this business person to look for investment opportunities around the world. And he eventually came to Vietnam to start this operation. KMT eventually pulled out when staff changed, staff were replaced by other new people who were not very keen in this project for some reason. But the business person stayed pursuing this project. But initially, this was in a marshland, and we used to be where many of the combat units used to hide when Vietnam was fighting in the U.S. And this was seen to be like one of the war zones in Ho Chi Minh City. And therefore, people, when they were hearing about the new unit and villas going up, at initially not the high rise, but villas going up in this area, which used to be known as war zones, they were not very keen to move into this place. And it was also a place which was known for marshland, not very in a habitable situation. But somehow, over the next few years, the Phu My Hong developed a complex, including about 2,000 apartment units that was completed in year 2000, which was initially supplied at a very bit of discounted price, 30% of the price of the main part of the city. But the condition they came with was a bit of something new to the population of Ho Chi Minh City. And despite the low price, eventually, the words of mouth going around and saying, oh, this is a wonderful place, very planned, clean, with all the facilities, amenities that cannot be found in main parts of Ho Chi Minh City. Eventually, the price simply going up and up to reach this level of prices within the next few years. Prices of residential apartments in this particular place, Phu My Hong area, skyrocketing to between $800 and $1,200 per square meter, which was three times what can be found in main part of the city. So from about 30% of the price of the main part of the city, in the next few years, skyrocketing to three times. So that was a bit of a sensation, and that kind of kickstarted the process of further subsequent development promoted by Phu My Hong, and also influencing other developers within Vietnam. Yes. And then you begin to see other operators. So let me just briefly introduce what can be found as major players. So you have Capital Land Singapore, which is one of Asia's largest real estate companies, having head office in Singapore, and having basically operating globally. It's also something that has been seeing heavy presence in Vietnam. Especially, it's interesting how Capital Land, coming from Singapore, has been closely associated with the Singapore sovereign wealth fund Temasek, and Temasek having the highest in becoming the largest shareholder of Capital Land, which has been operating around the world. Most of the countries they operate are seeing service to residents in the UK and elsewhere, or mostly service to residents, but only in Southeast Asia, like Vietnam and so on, they get involved in real estate, in a commercial real estate development. So Somerset Residence, I don't know whether anyone has been using Somerset, is the one run by Capital Land. So that kind of service to residents is the main forms of service provision in the property sector by Capital Land in many countries. But in Southeast Asia, they get involved in these projects that you see on the right hand side, which are largely aiming at mid to high income and households emerging in Vietnam. There's another Capital Land, which also has a bit of Temasek presence, which owns about 20% of Capital Corporation. So Capital Land is the subsidiary of Capital Corporation. It also has a little smaller presence, but still major presence in Ho Chi Minh City in particular, where their projects are concentrated. And they have also been working very heavily, as given the Capital's involvement in logistics, infrastructure, and so on. They've been operating in many cities of China, including the provision of the Sino-Tianjin, the eco-city construction as well. But Singapore has a longer presence when you actually look at the history, from as early as 1994. The kind of government-to-government agreement to start the project to invite Singaporean the state-owned enterprises to be investing in Vietnam, especially with the setting up of many industrial parks. So VSIP is the one which is the joint venture company set up between Singapore and Taiwan governmental and institution players to start and develop the industrial parks around Vietnam. So what is also interesting is, in this case, the industrial parks are not just confined to the provision of manufacturing facilities and other infrastructure service provision, but increasingly nowadays, as in the case of Bắc Ninh near Hanoi, is including industrial, retail, as well as residential in order to provide services for those workers and their family members who are predominantly meant to be residing within and close to these industrial parks. Yeah, and yes, there are Korean developers, such as Hyundai or POSCO. POSCO used to be the major steel producer, the largest steel producer, which has gone through privatization in the late 1990s onward and has become a major player in property development as well, using the subsidiary of the company. And Daewoo and Booyong, all these some of the selections which used to be quite active in the Vietnam's property market. And this is just an example of POSCO, and you can kind of hear a lot about the project called Splendora in Hanoi. I'll come back to this in a bit later when you discuss the land issue. So it's a very large scale new town development involving POSCO's provision of the master plan and also POSCO's involvement as developer to provide these luxury condominiums and villas in this part of the city. And this is on the outskirts of Hanoi. But you also get to see very local, active local developers. And Vinhomes, especially in Hanoi, in North Vietnam, tends to be the major player and expanding to reach out to Ho Chi Minh City as well. And these are quite interesting in terms of, again, in a short while, when I come to discuss the land issue, Vinhomes are known to be very actively engaging with property development by means of using their close connections with the government in terms of securing the very strategic land places within the city of Hanoi and elsewhere, especially in Hanoi. So these the numbers that you see in the map, sorry for the clarity of the map, but all these numbers in red, 1 to 14 are the locations of Vinhomes in real estate development, and which are very close to city centers. The historic center, historic quarter of Hanoi, being very much in this area around the lake and so on. But these are very much close to city center, and this is one of the regions many foreign developers I was speaking to were referring to Vinhomes as to have very close relationship with the government, which was enabling them to secure these strategic locations close to city center, which allow them to sell properties developed in these sites to be sold at very high prices, whereas other foreign developers, without having access to those strategic sites proximate to city center, having to operate mostly in more peripheral new development locations. So this is the site you were looking at earlier in the background, the rural city, which is one of the latest developments by Vinhomes. And this is another interesting project. So whereas Fumihong is the one that can characterize the start of the high-rise and the condominium provision in Ho Chi Minh City, you get to see in Hanoi what is known as Zhonghua complex, which is again known to be among Koreans, the Korean town in Hanoi. And I forgot to mention, Fumihong is also known to be the Korean town in Ho Chi Minh City. It's actually the second largest Korean town abroad, from Korean towns involving mostly South Koreans, the largest one being in LA, Los Angeles, and the second largest one being in Ho Chi Minh City, in the Fumihong development. And in this case, yes, and the Koreans were also very active. They were very diligent to occupy parts of Zhonghua, as when Koreans were gradually, advancing into the Vietnam's property market. But this is one complex that is seen to be the very first in a commercial high-rise real estate project in Vietnam. And the architect I was speaking to was the masterminding this development in Hanoi, was very proud of this particular project having made a significant entry into Vietnam's real estate market, especially in Hanoi, especially with the introduction of new the culture of residence centered on high-rise condominiums. So this was in 2000. So if you kind of think of Fumihong, the completion of 2000 units was in 2000, and 6 years later, you get to see the first appearance of high-rise in this case by state-owned enterprise of Vietnam, Vinaconex, which was behind the construction of this project. And interestingly, the architect himself was studying doing his PhD in UCL, I think it was probably UCL, the Bartlett School of Planning, having acquired the PhD in there, and having kind of obtained this vision of high rise to be introduced in Vietnam as the new way of living. But apart from those Vinhomes dominating strategic locations in Hanoi close to city centers, most new development involving foreign developers will be concentrated in peri-urban development, peri-urban places, where the new towns are being promoted by local government as a way of expanding cities and developmental spaces. So the example in this case, and I was having a chance to visit on several occasions, is in Ho Chi Minh City's 2TM new town, new development, which is on the west, the eastern side of the existing CBD across the river, as you see here. So if you actually look at this in a picture, this is the 2TM peninsula, and across the river to this direction, there will be the old CBD. And this is one of the master plans, which is essentially trying to develop the entire peninsula into a brand new town, it's like kind of, to some extent, as a person who have studied in the Chinese cities, it feels like they are trying to create another Pudong kind of in a style development, that kind of in a typology and urban built forms. So on the left-hand side, this is the old CBD, the historic places of Ho Chi Minh City. And to the left, there will be a new CBD. But in this case, the entire place, which used to be agricultural, low-rise, almost negligent commercial development up until recent years, and largely, partly because of very poor connections, the bridges which are connecting the old historic center with the Dutiem area were more or less recently built. And with the new infrastructure in place, the entire peninsula beginning to see growing opportunities for accommodating high-rise and new development, and in this case, a lot of the high-rise luxury mid to high-end development are being conceived. What is also interesting in this case is because these are coming in at a later stage in more recent years, you get to see the acknowledgement of heavier presence of local developers. So this is a report produced by Capital Land, and when they were promoting the Empire City New Development Project in Ho Chi Minh City, the market analysis document was reporting to Dutiem, where the Empire City project by Capulan was located, as to witness a huge competition coming from because of the heavy presence of local Vietnamese developers who are making use of their close connections with the government and also their own local knowledge. Being very much heavily showing their presence in the real estate market, especially in this mid to higher end. When you look at the kind of more urban expansion wise, very briefly speaking, Hanoi you can kind of see how Hanoi has been also expanding very rapidly in recent years. So these red ones are the former territory of Hanoi, whereas these ones are the new acquisitions. So those areas which used to belong to neighboring provinces will be detached from the neighboring province in order to merge with Hanoi, in order for Hanoi to have extra room for development. And a lot of the new developments I would be reporting to, and especially by Capital Land or Capital Land and so on, are mostly on this periphery, just outside the existing Hanoi's existing territory before the merging, and so you can kind of see along this along the boundary between previous Hanoi territory and the new territory of Hanoi, you get to see the bit of concentration of new development, especially by Vinhomes foreign developers, and Vinhomes tend to be within the existing territory of Hanoi. And this is, to some extent, a very interesting way of thinking about the aspirations of Vietnam's new middle and upper classes, and the aspirations among Chinese and the Singaporeans and South Koreans, especially when they think of making decisions to invest in Vietnam. So, where on the one hand, with the growing affluence of Vietnam's population, and especially when you look at the top income earners, like top 20% or top 10%, who are in search for those places which conform to their own style of living, as they increasingly have access to markets outside Vietnam, through traveling, through education, and so on, who have access to different types of lifestyles, especially Singapore, often packaged as like a Singapore model, something that comes with very well maintained housing estate in a spacious good collection of amenities like swimming pools and a concierge and so on. These are something the Singaporean developers are also promoting them service and feeling very proud. But at the same time, it's also going to be interesting what that also means for the poorer end of the population and the top end. So in this case, I just kind of put together the average dwelling space per capita by residence, especially just concentrating on urban residents. So by 2014, per capita urban dwelling space wise, it was reaching about 24 square meters. And if you think of 3.7-ish in members per household, you can kind of think of about somewhere between 75 to 80 square meters per household as the average in a dwelling space per household. The top quintile of income as of 2014 will be seen to are known to be enjoying about 30 square meters. So you get whereas the bottom quintile experiencing a little less than half of what the top quintile members of society were having access to. Now, a lot of these in the promotion wise, there are many major promotion in when you think about the aspirations of middle classes and from Singapore and elsewhere investing in Vietnam's and the housing market. You get to see a lot of these in a promotion event. So when I was staying in this accommodation in Vietnam, I was actually staying in CapitaLand provides Somerset in Hanoi to have access to CapitaLand services as part of my research. Yes, but then it was actually interesting to see on the ground floor all these advertisements to attract investors. Invited to this home bazaar, which is actually in a estate which was promoting the sales and having a sales promotion to overseas investors as well as Vietnamese local investors. And you get to see what they were actually putting together, especially when it comes to all this guide for foreign investors on residential property investment. And this was produced not by CapitaLand, but by CapitaLand. Looking at these three in a key aspect in particular, capital appreciation, the booming property market leading to the opportunity to make more profits as you extend your possession. The opportunity to get to have access to rental yield and the affordability, not for Vietnamese, but for Singaporeans and Koreans. So when it comes to, I'll talk about the affordability fairly soon, but a lot of the cross-border investment activities by Koreans, and you get to see in so-called Korean towns, a lot of Korean estate agents operating. And many of these promotional activities, at the bottom left is the one that was associated with this in a pamphlet and a home bazaar event. But aspiration among among Vietnamese in terms of having access to Singaporean style of living, especially the kind of resort style, that comes with a full package of amenities that Singaporean project sites are providing. And very premium facilities, top-notch services, again provided by these in a new development and by CapitaLand and so on. But to some extent, there's also an interesting way of looking at how the aspirational urbanism is being consumed by Vietnamese, who on the one hand accessed the foreign developer or Vinhomes provided new luxury commercial project sites, but at the same time, they also, with the presence to live in villas or landed properties, also, these villas are being part of the major packages that come with new development or in adjacent areas. So unlike the Korean developers who are predominantly focusing on high-rise when they operate within South Korea, they try to combine the landed property development villas with high-rise on the same site in order to target different taste of Vietnam's higher-end population. What is interesting here in the land grabbing wise, basically the securing of the land becomes very important, and this is one of the reasons why new developers will be expanding into new development spaces like Dutiem and so on, the peripheral spaces which are earmarked for new development, right? And without having access to densely populated inner city spaces. And local developers having this close connection with the local authorities, so you get to see a bit of in a crony capitalism kind of situation when it comes to Vietnamese local developers' way of operating, whereas Singaporean developers are preferring to enter into consortium with local developers, while Korean developers preferring to fully own the project. And this is something which tends to be quite an interesting distinction made between Singaporean and South Korean developers. But what is also interesting in the case of Korean developers is the way in which they tend to hold on to the land for a longer period before seeing the completion of the project. It's kind of land banking exercise being one predominant exercise practice among Singaporeans, and something that even among Koreans which is something that Singaporean developers were also pointing out. Oh, South Korean South Korean developers tend to keep the land without doing something, just waiting for the price of the land to increase. So the longer they wait, the price goes up, so they don't actually lose anything, and then doing something just enough to extend their license to keep the land in their possession. Because a lot of the license, investment license, will come with fixed number of years for the completion of the project. Otherwise, it will expire, and it will be very difficult to expire when that happens. But then they do just enough to keep the license renewed and to keep the land in their own possession. Oops, that was a bit too fast. So, this is just an indication to demonstrate how important it is when it comes to such development in an emerging market context. And the land, securing a piece of land is going to be very important. But especially in a transitional economic context, how important it is to address the barriers and the demands coming from local households, but also the constraints imposed upon by the presence of what is known as socialist landmasters. And this was the expression in the context of mainland China by a geographer, Yu-Tien Singh, from the US, who was looking at how the institutional players, armies or state-owned enterprises, government institutions, which used to occupy a piece of land for a long period, when the real estate market emerges, they tend to act in a similar way as developers, rather than handing over their properties to governments which have the legitimate right to actually make use of the properties and turn that into different use. But these socialist landmasters, because of their heavy presence and the influence, connection with a higher ranking government, they tend to also position themselves in such a way in the property market to benefit from real estate development. So it's quite important to see how these players also have to be addressed, have to go through negotiations. And developers who have a very poor connection with the government will be much more difficult to actually secure such a piece of land. And in this regard, foreign developers, on the one hand, like Singapore, Singaporean developers, the reason for them to operate together in consortium with local developers is largely because the local developers are supplying the land with their own connection with the government, while Singaporean developers provide cash input, right? So this is the situation of Estella and Estella Heights by Capital Land, where their license and a certificate will indicate, yes, the local developer provides 45% of the capital for the joint venture company, but this 45% in kind, the land development, the land provided by local partner, the value of the land equivalent to 45% of the capital of the joint venture, whereas the remaining 55% provided in cash by Capital Land to set up this joint venture company. Sorry, there's a glitch with the system. And the same goes to another Riviera point, similar situation. The land provided by local partner of the Singaporean developer becomes very important factor. And this is what I was referring to, loan project delays by Korean developers because of the kind of general tendency to hold on to the land without really seeing the completion in the way Singaporean developers tend to practice. A very, very good example used to be Buyong, which is actually quite going through a bit of a controversial situation now because the CEO of Buyong, which is one of the major developers in South Korea, largely operating within social rental housing provision sector, but the CEO has been arrested for due to corruption and so on. So, but Buyong, in the case of Vietnam's Ho Chi Minh, Hanoi, real estate market, has been holding on to this piece of land for quite a few years, and only begin to see a bit of development. Now, if I may, actually, I guess given the time constraint, just a few points to go through as kind of what implications, social and spatial. I think one major implication is the emergence of the enclave urbanism because of the way in which these real estate complexes are emerging and how they are targeting certain segments of the consumers within Vietnam, especially the very high end. So I was trying to do some calculation making use of annual average income using the 2010 data. and you know, what a top quintile household would be earning per year, and what bottom quintile would be making in a given year. And you get to see like Vinhomes, which is one of the, in this case, is a very in a very top end of the real estate in the market, coming with 4,000 million dong per 100 square meters, with a price of 40 million dong per square meter as the sales price, or 62 million. That's about in a maximum 200,000 pounds per 100 square meter flat. And this is really about 225 times the annual household income for the bottom quintile, and 28 times the annual household income for the top quintile. Yeah, bit in a more affordable in a range. Here comes Estella Heights by in a Capital Land, comes with 25 million dong per square meter. So that's about 60% of the price of the capital by Vinhomes. And this is a bit more affordable for the top quintile, right? And 11 times the annual household income, but still 90 times the household income per year for the bottom quintile. So you can kind of see, yes, I mean, the whole in a complex coming with in a complete package of amenities, services provided, all paid for, coming with this very gated and enclave urbanism that emerges throughout the peri-urban areas, and in certain city spaces, if it's involving Vinhomes or similar types of local developers, and predominantly you get to see the players in the upper range of the housing market. And very often you get to understand, yes, on the one hand, developers are seeing this in the presence of, yes, South Korean and real estate developers like Hyundai, Daewoo, or Booyong, or POSCO, ENC, Singaporean developers like Keppel Land, Capital Land, and so on. What is also interesting through my interviews is how South Koreans who used to go to China to invest, to run their business as individuals, are now migrating to Vietnam when the prices are going high and it's a bit less affordable to run their business, and they come to Vietnam, and a lot of the inquiries made to South Korean property agents were involving those coming from who are thinking of relocating from Chinese cities to Vietnamese cities like Ho Chi Minh City or Hanoi. The same goes to many people from South Korea, but in this case, who are thinking of investing in Vietnam's emerging higher-end property market, and very often without having to transfer their money from Vietnam, from Korea to Vietnam. So one of the interesting ways of doing the transaction was what is known as in Korean terms, hwanchigi, which is essentially without having to do a bank transfer, international bank transfer. You have an agent locate one in Korea, another in Vietnam, who are doing the transaction, but the actual money that you pay doesn't leave the country, while the buyer will be receiving the money through another end, and there will be connections made between two agents operating in different countries, and in order to evade taxation or the regulatory scrutinies and so on. So there comes the issue of nominally socialist Republic of Vietnam, when it comes to the promotion of very high-end luxury enclave based in the new housing estate. What does it actually mean for the people, right? And when it comes to the socialist the ideas versus the reality people come to see. And there is always the questioning of the legitimacy of the local government. And I must say, it was quite a joy actually to see the statue of Lenin, which is not existing in many former socialist countries. Speculation gone wrong, especially the villas, or especially in the outskirts. This is one situation in the outskirts, northeastern outskirts of Hanoi, where the villas all sold out, but not occupied, and remaining as sort of in a ghost townish situation, without having gone through maintenance. No occupation, and therefore just running down, and that becomes a major issue. And essentially, the last question is: yes, I mean, it's something I keep thinking about. Whose cities, are being produced and reproduced, with the contribution coming from developers from Vietnam and developers from South Korean and Singaporean origins, and how how much they actually make a contribution. to the well-being, and it's essentially creating more bifurcated inner cities, as I can see up until now in Hanoi and Ho Chi Minh City. So I think I'll stop there and look forward to some comments and feedbacks from you. Thank you very much.